Welcome to How to Seriously Evaluate Your Camp Outcomes, and thank you for listening to this. I hope this will be a very valuable educational experience, and that at the end, you'll really understand the whole evaluation process as it needs to be done in order to truly understand what it is that your camp does, and how, as a result of that information, you can better help your kids. The goals of this session are to provide an overview of the evaluation process, to help you understand the key issues and concerns, to be a good consumer of evaluative information, to learn how to hire an evaluator, and to provide time for questions and discussion, which in this case really won't be appropriate. Also, again, you won't be able to ask questions as we go along, but you will be able to email me and call me if you do have further questions about the material. And I definitely applaud you for listening to this, because again, this is the information that will really help you understand what it is the camp does and how you can help the children better. Some realities. This is really part of a trilogy of sessions. So the first session here, which is this one, How to Seriously Evaluate Your Outcomes, is sort of the overview of the evaluative process. The second one, Measuring the Softer Outcomes, really goes into more detail into what it is that makes a good measure. It's quite the concept to say that how somebody fills out a measure in a few minutes or so is going to predict their later behavior and life outcomes. And so that tells you about the process and what to look for. There's over 25 things, and I'll just touch on that a little bit later. Also, a process and implementation evaluation. We'll spend a bit of time on that in this presentation, but a more fuller description and discussion of that takes place in an entire different presentation. Highly valuable, and if there were one thing that I think I could have camps do by a wave of the magic wand, this would be it. If they could really do their process and implementation evaluation of their camp program, it would help them enormously. So I can't tell you everything you need to know, and evaluation is certainly not quick, simple, or easy, but it is worthwhile. So the next slide, books on evaluation, general text, the specific how-to areas and the websites, those I just give you because they're good to reference, and to let you know that there really is an enormous amount of material out there. Normally I'd also ask what your expectations are, but again, not appropriate for here. So, first we're going to cover the goals of evaluation, which we've already done. Why evaluate, we'll get to in just a moment. The problems with the ways of knowing, a little exercise. And what is often still unknown with the way evaluation is typically done. And then we're going to get right into the steps in the evaluative process. A needs assessment, understanding completely what you do, which is the process modeling, picking which outcomes to evaluate, and designing an evaluation plan and methods. After that, we'll go into actually conducting the evaluation, analyzing the results, utilizing them, and then the last step is to begin again. Other points we'll cover are the top 15 evaluation mistakes, how to hire an evaluator, and different roles for evaluators. So there's quite a bit to cover here, but we should be done in reasonable amount of time, much shorter than if this were actually given live. So, why evaluate? Well, as you can see from the slide, you can utilize the results to improve how outcomes are addressed, to start a change initiative, and to examine the strengths and weaknesses and the reasons for both. You can distribute the results for all of these other reasons, and I'll just let you read through those. Lots of great reasons to go through an evaluative process. Now, you'll notice that most of them are in red, and only two are in black. So I'll let you try and think about that for a second. You can hit pause if you like. The reason is, the two in black are only the result of a serious, accurate evaluative process. All the others can likely be done with a less formal, less rigorous evaluation. Mainly because most people don't really know how to look at evaluation data and to understand it. But for those who do, and for those who are interested in really knowing what it is their camps are doing and how they can help the children better, there is absolutely no substitute for a serious evaluative process. And that is what we'll be going through today. So first I ask you, the next slide, how do you know if you give kids a world of good or not? This is the question everyone should be asking themselves. How do you know if you give kids a world of good or not? Stop here, hit pause, hit stop, or rather, probably not stop, hit pause, And think about this. Write it down. Go through this little exercise. And when you're ready, let's continue. Okay, so you've had a little chance to think about what you do. Now, I want to show you a little list of outcomes. This is a list of outcomes as a result of a camp experience. It isn't exhaustive, but it's a pretty comprehensive list of all the things camp might achieve. So, think about what your camp does in relation to all of these outcomes. Now, I've separated into the cognitive, emotional, and behavioral sort of sides and the bottom spirituality, but where each one lies could shift depending on how you slice it. This is just a rough categorization and a general list to give you an idea. Okay, so some of the ways you probably came up with ways of knowing whether or not you give kids a world of good or not is parents and campers tell me. So, stories of how camp changed lives. So I'll have the parent who says that, you know, Johnny or Jane is so much different and better now as a result of the camp experience, or the campers tell you themselves. So that is certainly one way of knowing. Another is because parents keep sending their kids back, otherwise the return rate. Perhaps you've also gone so far as to measure actual behaviors, or to measure attitudes and mental states. And we'll go over the problems, next slide, with all of these ways of knowing. Issue with the qualitative data, such as the parent and the child tell you, is because of the sense of memory and the social desirable responding, and I'll go through that in a little more detail. In fact, this slide is an outline of the next few things we'll go over. Also, because of a camp's return rate. We'll go over that. Interventions that sometimes falter is a little example, and valid and reliable information. If you're going to be measuring attitudes and behaviors, you need to have valid, reliable information. We'll be going over that briefly as well. First, sense of memory. Okay, there are several problems with the way human memory works, one of which is transience. Over time, things are forgotten. So when exactly did Jane change? How much did Jane do before camp? What exactly was Jane like before camp? You'd be surprised how transient memory is. In fact, there was one cute study that they asked married couples to answer simply yes or no if they've had sex within the last 24 hours. Only 80% of them got it right. Now that's something you would have expected at least 100% to get right. But in reality, only 80%. So, memory is quite transient. Absent-mindedness, not paying close attention. So the camp program wasn't monitored closely, and the parents might not be able to reliably identify the camp outcomes and what led to each. Now this is, I think, often the case. I've done this sort of thing with parents, and I've asked them, you know, to pick out a list of outcomes of the camp experience, ones that were likely as a result of this particular camp and ones that weren't. Parents were unable to pick out things that should and should not have been an outcome of the camp experience because they really weren't paying close attention. Misattribution. The change occurred elsewhere. It happened at school, church, mentor, friend. Source confusion here. Let me give you an example. A few examples. One, DNA evidence. So they've had all these people who were convicted, some of which were even on death row. However, the DNA evidence came out and they were vindicated. Turns out that 90% of the time these people were convicted by eyewitness testimony. Someone had to sit on the stand, look these people in the eye, and say, "This is the person that did it. This is the person that you should send to jail, that you should put to death, because they did it." They were really, really sure, but they were wrong. People misattribute things all the time. Commercials. You know, it's no accident that they have, you know, attractive, sometimes sexy people or lots of gimmicks, you know, the Super Bowl commercials. They're trying to get you to misattribute attractive people with a product. All sorts of misattribution going on there. That's their business. Depression. Depressed people misattribute various life events all the time. Gambler's fallacy. People think they have more control than they really do. So even when you tell somebody, these are the odds if you play this game in a casino, they're still going to believe, they have the gambler's fallacy, which is pretty common, that they particularly will have a better outcome than everybody else, which isn't usually true, especially the longer you play. And suggestibility, the last on this slide. You incorporate information provided by others. So, the marketing materials the parents got. That's highly suggestive of camp outcomes. they're likely to see those things, and also in their talks with the director and other people, and believe that those are outcomes because it was suggested. Human memory is highly suggestible. Lots of evidence here. Hypnosis, eyewitness testimony, leading questions, re-interviewing. Frequently people are suggestible to various things. For example, they do these mock trials with mock juries, and they'll change just one little thing. For example, when they're interviewing a key witness, they'll say something like, "Did you know that, you know, Mr. Hoffa was in the mafia?" And they'll say, "Well, no, I wasn't in the mafia." And this sort of thing, just these little comments that aren't true, but nonetheless they would sway the outcome of trial. Okay, on to the next slide, bias and dissonance. Now, I do want to say here, before I continue, that certainly all of these things are not absolutely occurring, but each of them might be occurring, and more often than not, probably one of them, in some way or another, is under just stories. Bias. So memory encoding and retrieval are highly dependent on and influenced by pre-existing knowledge and beliefs. So much of perception depends upon why the parents sent their child to camp in the first place. For example, the parent likes you, and they confound liking you with the results and outcomes. Because they like you, they want to believe that it happened. Also, counselors' ratings of their children are also, in a way, a rating of their own performance. So, if they have a high self-esteem, and you probably tried to hire counselors with a high self-esteem, they might be more inclined to rate the children better, because, in a way, it's a reflection of their own performance. Dissonance. When given the free choice and significant effort or money has been expended, people often believe their decisions and attitudes are correct. I said I like camp, and I still do. So, to justify their decision to send their child to your camp and spend the money on that decision, parents will believe camp was beneficial and worthwhile. There's been a whole book, one recently published in 1999 from the American Psychological Association, that totally just talked. The sole subject is dissonance and how common it is in everyday life. Next slide. Issues with qualitative data. So, social desirable responding. They tell you what you want to hear just because they want to be nice. Also, they may not want to deal with a confrontation, so they just avoid the issue altogether. Now, a caveat. This is not to say that all qualitative data is wrong or bad, but rather that there are critical issues which limit our ability to have faith in the results and determine cause. Used appropriately, qualitative data is invaluable, and we'll get into that in a little bit. Inappropriately used, it may do more harm than good. You may believe those stellar stories, which may indeed be true, of, you know, these key kids that went to camp and they're doing all these things differently as a result of it, etc. That may indeed be true, but there are a lot of things that aren't known, and to base decisions based on that, especially given all the sins of memory and the other problems, that isn't usually a wise decision. It's much better to have a systematic look at what is going on and why. So, because of camp's return rate, this is often frequently a response I get. I don't need to evaluate. I know I'm doing well because the kids keep coming back. Well, there's some problems with that. First, parents might send their children back to camp for all sorts of reasons. They really aren't the logical, bean-counting psychometricians capable of accurately assessing all outcomes that we often give them credit for. Let me give you a couple examples. IQ is the most frequent assessment in the country, but teachers are poor predictors of it. If they were good predictors of it, we wouldn't bother with IQ tests in the first place. We'd just ask the teachers. But they're not good predictors of it, which is why we give the IQ test. Self-esteem is another example. People often believe they can tell or predict somebody else's self-esteem. In fact, that's not the case. Other people tend to be extraordinarily poor predictors of self-esteem. I've done this myself with counselors and directors, having them guess either globally or change in self-esteem. They never get it right, no more so than you'd expect by chance. Okay, second point here is that even if, let's say you assume, that parents were accurate predictors of the outcomes, the model would be complex and different for every parent. So let me give you an example of four parents. One says the return decision is 0.43 fun, 43% fun, 12% self-esteem, 27% safety, 18% because they like the director. Another, 21% fun, 24% because they believe their child is more extroverted, and 55% because their friends are returning. Another parent, 36% because the child picked up a lot of environmental attitudes and awareness. Very green parents, they appreciate that. 41% because the child gained a lot of emotional intelligence skills, and 23% because of creativity skills. The fourth parent D, the return decision is based on 36% fun, 22% they like the director, and 42% because they don't want to go through all the effort of picking another camp. This one's good enough, it seems good, everyone likes it, good, okay, fine, we're sending the child back. Problem is that you don't know why a parent is sending their child back. And the reason differs for every single parent. So saying the parents, because of the return rate, your camp is achieving its outcomes, is inaccurate. There's no way to know to what degree what outcomes are being achieved and which ones aren't. And again, even if you do take that as, you know, some sort of accuracy, you have to believe that parents are accurate predictors of all these things, which indeed, more often than not, especially when it comes to these softer skills, they're not. So, camp return rate in and of itself is not a good outcome measurement. Interventions that sometimes falter. Not all schools or all religious institutions churn out people who are entirely religious or who are gain all the skills that one would hope as a result of a school experience. These things sometimes falter. It would be important to know who's benefiting, who's not, and why. DARE, we'll get into this later, but DARE was a horrible failure of a program for quite a long time, despite the fact it had raving reviews from people involved with the program. If you asked them, parents included, they would have told you DARE was doing a fabulous job. It wasn't. With my own work with several different camps, camps often believe that they're doing a fabulous job of helping, say, 80% of the children who walk through the door. Well, that might be the case, but it might not be. And when you go through an evaluative process, you'll understand which kids are, which kids aren't, and why. Extremely valuable. And by going through it, you'll be much more able to help the children. We'll come back to all this in a bit. Valid and reliable information. So this gets back to the point if some people say, well, we measured their attitudes, or we measured some sort of, you know, psychological state or behavior or something like that. That's fine, but you have to meet the criteria when you have this measure, use any sort of measurement, of a valid and reliable measure. Now, as I'll show you a little bit later on, and is the topic of a whole other presentation, there are numerous criteria necessary to meet these standards, and most measures don't. Valid. What you're actually attempting to measure is what is being measured. So if you have a measure of self-esteem, when the child fills it out, what you get back is actually self-esteem. Incredibly difficult to achieve, especially when you want predictive or discriminant validity, which we'll get to later. Very, very important, most often not the case. Reliable. When the outcome is assessed again in a short period of time, stable outcomes should remain stable, the same, and unstable ones should vary. So self-esteem, from one week to another, should stay the same. The score should be the same. Unstable outcomes like mood are probably going to vary quite a bit. If you don't have a reliable measure of whatever it is, you're not really going to know how to interpret your results. For example, if you have this self-esteem measure or something like that and it isn't very reliable, you won't know that as a result of your 1, 2, or 3 week program, if the kids benefited, if they went down, or stayed the same. You won't be able to attribute that to the program because just by, you know, the time that passed from time one to time two, the measure is going to vary somewhat. So you don't know if it's error in the measure or a real change. Again, very difficult to meet all the criteria. We'll come back to this later. So even when qualitative and quantitative ways of knowing are used correctly, there are still many critical questions that casual evaluations often leave out. Again, I don't want to say that all qualitative data bad, quantitative data is bad, but even when they are used correctly, there's a lot of things that still need to be known. So, the next slide, what is still often unknown? Now, all of these questions apply for each outcome involved. Keep that in mind. What are the processes involved? What leads to the outcomes? We'll talk about more of this in a bit. What is the magnitude of the effect? How big is it? So what if you went a score from a 62 to a 69, from 0 to 80? What difference does that make in reality? So you want to know if there's some meaningful effect there, and how large it is. You want to know how many people benefit. Do 20% of your kids benefit in this in environmental attitudes and awareness? Do 60% benefit on self-confidence and independence? Also at camp, who does and does not benefit is why. And you'll see here a long list of things which I'll address. Age. Do younger campers benefit more or less than older campers? Ethnicity. If you have several ethnicities at your camp, do they go through the program with a different sort of experience in some way or another because of their background or because of how they're treated, either one? Gender. Do males have better outcomes on skills than females? Do females have better self-esteem as a result of the camp experience than males? This sort of thing. How many summers make a difference? Very important question. You want to know if there's a diminishing returns effect. So if they have a certain benefit at the result of one summer, how much is the benefit at the end of the second summer, third summer, etc.? Or, perhaps, there's sort of this delayed effect. You need to have two summers before you see something. You might do this outcome evaluation where you assess the end from, you know, before to after the summer, and you don't find an effect. Well, maybe they really have to come back for more than one summer to get the benefit. Socioeconomic level, parenting style, family functioning, parental education, number of siblings, all of these things are kind of family level variables. Very important to know. Does a child who comes from this democratic parenting style, authoritarian, authoritative, that sort of thing, does that make a difference in the kind of experience the child has at camp? Also, for family functioning, and if the child is active in a religious experience or they come from a very good school, there are many other domains that children are involved in. And those might be doing a fabulous job. So, I often think of, you know, we say, you know, camp gives kids a world of good, and I'm certainly convinced that it does. But if we were to stand up in front of a bunch of teachers and the principal, a bunch of religious leaders, this sort of thing, and parents, you know, perhaps like yourself, and you say to them, you know, really, it is camp that can help children above and beyond all these things. No matter how good all of you are, we do these things better. That may be the case in some things and not in others. Extremely important to know where these children come from, where they're strong, where they're weak, how camp can help. The level and type of participation outputs. We'll get to this in a bit, but it matters quite a bit to what degree the child participated. Did they go on the three-night overnight? If they didn't, maybe they don't have the same degree of self-confidence as child who did. The child's desire to go to camp. Did you have to peel them off the banister rail, or did they come willingly? Counselor's group performance. As much as we'd hate to admit it, I'm sure that everyone would agree that there are some counselors who are certainly more effective than others. If the children were, especially if you have a very group-centered kind of camp, counselor group performance is rated by a few people, might help explain the degree and longevity of outcomes. The level on an outcome. So a child who comes with a high self-esteem probably isn't going to benefit as much as a child with a moderate self-esteem. Things are important to notice. Otherwise, you might say, well, camp didn't have an effect, but really you're looking at the wrong kind of question. You're looking at everyone as a whole, and you need to split it by where they came in the first place. Parental camp experience. So maybe the parent went to camp and they achieved all these benefits. And sort of this long-term idea, you'd think that if the parents had the benefits of camp, they would pass those on to those children, and therefore the children with a parental camp experience might benefit less because they already have the benefits because the parents went to camp, if you're able to follow that. Other things, if they have a strong supportive peer group, the child's a good match practically with this type of camp, variability not captured by ethnicity, for example, or gender or something like that. Ethnicity researchers in particular go absolutely nuts when you just have these little check boxes and you try and analyze this data this way, where you say, okay, whether or not they were Caucasian or Hispanic or African American, it's like saying that all females are exactly the same. You either check male or you check female, and everyone who's male is male, and everyone who's female is female. Clearly, that's not the case. Very difficult to measure it in a more accurate way, but there certainly is variability not captured by these sort of bucket little checklist kind of things. Idiosyncratic experiences at camp. For example, perhaps a child in a particular cabin was the scapegoat, and they didn't have quite as good a summer as they might. That's very important to know, so that when you're looking at the data and you say, well, this child didn't benefit, you might be able to come back to that and know why. The next slide, unknown part two. Again, all of these apply for every outcome involved. Do you help any child or largely the population served? This is sort of the needs assessment question. We'll get to that in a second. If you had a difficult child, maybe difficult children don't benefit as much as children who are less difficult. Something to keep in mind, or level of outcome, as I mentioned before. How long does the effect last? 2, 4, 12, 20 weeks after camp? And how would you tell an adult camper apart from a non-camper who is similar really in every other way? Could the benefit be achieved cheaper or better elsewhere? Maybe you have them for 4 weeks and it really only takes 5 days. The type of programming, back to sort of the type of good match with the type of camp, or perhaps they don't need a camp experience. Perhaps a different kind of program could achieve the same end, or another intervention entirely could achieve the same end. All things to keep in mind. So let's review. Why evaluate? All of these reasons. Seriously evaluate so that you can really improve how your outcomes are addressed and examine your strengths and weaknesses. Casual evaluations, especially based on inaccurate measures, might achieve some of these other ends, but the point, really, we're all here is to help the kids. And to do that, you need a serious evaluation. Problems with the ways of knowing, qualitative data, the sins of memory, the social desire while responding, the problems with saying that your camp achieves its outcome because of the return rate, interventions that sometimes falter, valid and reliable information, and what is still often unknown. Okay, so how do you go about seriously evaluating whether or not, to what degree, and how your camp achieves its outcomes? As you can see here, there are 8 steps involved, and we'll go through each of those in order. Starting with the needs assessment. So what are the needs of the campers who show up on opening day? They're certainly not all the same. Every child is an individual. Do they have high self-esteem? Do they come from poor schools? Do they have a good family? Do they have poor social skills? Do they need a spiritual connection? Do they come with a moderate level of independence? Do they already respect the environment to a great deal? It's very important to know what kind of camper is walking through your door, especially when you're looking at outcome data later. Also, it's unlikely that a camp influences all the targeted outcomes to the same degree. What outcomes are in your sort of tier one level of service? Remember, there's a long list of outcomes. It's unlikely that all of those are influenced. What's in your tier one level of service? And do the above 2 points match? Do the campers need what you're offering? Next step, understanding completely what you do. This is the process map. We'll spend quite a bit of time here. Again, there's a whole other presentation on this entirely. Extremely valuable tool. Process maps are logic models. So how do you achieve your outcomes? What are the processes involved? Do all the stakeholders understand your processes? Are they theoretically accurate, and are they being implemented well? This is what we're going to be going through. This is sort of an outline for the next few slides. The United Way model. So here you can see inputs lead to activities, lead to outputs, lead to outcomes. So this is their model, pretty popular. I find there's some problems with it, especially when thinking about camp. But let me just go through it briefly. Inputs are the resources dedicated or consumed by the program. Money, staff time, equipment, facilities, that sort of thing. Activities are sort of what is done. So you feed and shelter homeless families. You counsel pregnant women. You do archery. You go on the 3-day backpacking trip. Outputs are the number of times sort of things are done. How long are kids at camp? The number of times they go to archery. That sort of thing. The outcomes. Things that are actually achieved for the children. Do they have new knowledge, increased skills, modified behavior, improved condition, altered status, etc.? So that's their outcome. I don't find it very useful as delineated here, so I'm going to show you my sort of adaptation of that model. So inputs, or what camp has. I think it's best to represent that just by the bubble camp. It's important to know what goes into that, but especially conceptually. So I'll talk about that more in a minute. So what are some inputs that go into what is camp? Orientation, well-trained staff. A low ratio, natural resources, facilities, session length, quality of staff, organizational hierarchy and structure, staff motivation, microcosm community, safe supportive environment, experiential learning, exceptional leadership on every level, adequate finances, and an individual treatment plan. These are all things that go into camp. Now, some things, such as session length, might be arguably an output, but that's quibbling. So for now, just think of all of these as inputs that make up camp. Okay, so if you go on to the next slide, you'll see I've delineated into what camp has, the inputs, camp, what camp does, which is activities, programs, and policies, and what effect does camp have, the outcomes. So go on to the next slide, and I'll define those three. Activities are things such as archery, a three-night hike, climbing wall, final banquet, rest hour, friendship circle, running club. All these things might be activities. Policies, non-competitive environment, camper bill of rights and responsibilities, reduce, reuse, recycle, only written contact with the family. Programs, leadership program, aquatics, sports, that sort of thing. Now for the policies and programs, they really do relate to more specifics, like the policies result in sort of specific behaviors as a result of them, and the programs can be broken down into all their little components. However, doing it that way often creates an extraordinarily cluttered process map, so I find it much better to represent things with policies and programs instead of all activities, as long as you keep that in mind. So deviations from the United Way model. Inputs, represent them with just the bubble camp when the aim is to communicate what camp does. But you do need to evaluate all the inputs, for example staff training, in order to understand the results on the outcomes. So this will be clear in a minute. Outputs are the number of times exposed to an activity. On a conceptual level, this is unnecessary and confusing. You don't really need, when communicating with staff and with parents and this sort of thing, to write down, you know, numbers next to each little bubble as you go along. Much better to leave that out. At camp, also, children often are exposed to the components a roughly equal number of times. And when they're not, it's important to understand what experiences an individual camper had, whether or not they went on that three-night hike. And on the whole, outputs are useful to consider when campers differ substantially in the activities or number of activities that they participate in. And again, orientation itself can be process mapped, highly useful thing to do, highly rewarding, and we'll get into that in another presentation, really. So let me just show you an example with general self-efficacy. So camp on the left yields general self-efficacy, which is psychologist way of saying self-confidence and independence, on the right. So things that would lead to that. Archery, tennis, campcraft, sailing, soccer, all these specific skills and activities are likely going to yield general self-efficacy. Three-night hike, ropes course, group initiatives, being away from home, all of these things will likely end up yielding a greater sense of self-confidence and independence. So, you go through, you map all your processes out, but you definitely still have a need for theory. When trying it to assess how it is you actually go about giving kids a world of good, you must use appropriate theories. And that's this sort of very obtuse, ivory tower kind of academic thing to say, but I'm going to explain now why that is absolutely crucial. Drawing it out does not equal the outcome. So take a minute. You can see camp on the left yields to increased self-esteem on the right. This might be something that's generated. And pick out which ones you think do and do not actually yield an increased self-esteem. Go ahead and hit pause now and give that a think. Okay, in reality, only the bottom one in general yield increased self-esteem. The top four generally do not. I should note that self-esteem is an incredibly difficult thing to influence. Studies over years show children with the same self-esteem, say from 9 to 15, children usually have the same level of self-esteem. Very, very, very difficult to influence. There are fluctuations, but the fluctuations tend not to last very long. So, one particular study is California really tried to show that all of these things, the top four and others, yielded a high or increased self-esteem. After spending 3 years and millions of dollars, both on the project and on the evaluation, the sum of the results were that it didn't help. It was a waste of time, it was a waste of money, the children didn't have increased self-esteem. I could go on about that, but there's a lot of other issues involved as well. Let me give you another example. Sounds good on paper, not good enough. The DARE program. 4.5 million kids served by 93. Targets 17 areas. Drug use, misuse, attitudes, consequences, resistance skills, social skills, self-esteem, etc. 60 minutes once a week for 17 weeks, and DARE instructors are trained for over 80 hours. I use this example because it has some similarities to the camp. Instructors are well-trained. It happens over a period of time. Targets several areas. The results? The effect was very, very small, or non-existent, with the exception of knowledge. Children knew, you know, more about what drugs were and the effects on the body, but it, in general, did not influence their behavior. The effects were so small, they were virtually non-existent. And, after 6 months, they were gone entirely. However, after a careful review and evaluation of the theories involved, DARE was redesigned, and it's now much better. There are now millions of children that are helped by the redesigned DARE program. The point is the need for theory and the reevaluation of it, and the evaluation to understand that DARE wasn't helping in the first place. If we just relied on our opinion of it, you know, DARE to keep kids off drugs and sort of the testimonials, we wouldn't have figured that out, and then we wouldn't have helped all these children that are being helped now. So theory-driven evaluation helps because it helps you pick the components that do and do not work. The self-esteem example helps you understand how effective components should be. So is being away from home enough, or do we need a ropes course and a challenging trip as well? And for whom should the processes work? Children with low self-esteem or social skills often need a different kind of process or intervention than children who have a moderate or high self-esteem. Children with low self-esteem tend to look at things very, very differently, and typical interventions often don't work. Do first-time campers with moderate levels on the outcome variable of interest benefit the most? So these sorts of questions are really helped by the theory. And identifying the key components that might be missing. The DARE example, it tells you where to look. It's also extremely important to utilize past research and a literature review. Without that, you're basically going forward without even looking in the library of knowledge about what people know does and does not work. Some example of useful theories. All of these are very applicable to the camp environment. Now, the one in red, theory of planned behavior, is the one that the DARE program used to revamp itself and to help the children. That one theory helped turn around the DARE program. Group socialization theory was also implicated, but primarily the theory of planned behavior. Again, all of this for every single outcome that you think you try and impact. So remain in quandary. You've mapped your processes, you've used theory, you've evaluated your key outcomes, and you found no effect on a few outcomes. So, what do you make of those results? You could say, well, it's the theory failure. More needs to be understood. So for self-esteem, you might say, we don't know enough about self-esteem to improve it. But there have been 65,000 studies of self-esteem. We really do have a very good idea of what does and does not improve self-esteem, and also what self-esteem is and why it isn't quite as important as we think it is. With something like spirituality, the theory is a little weaker. Program failure might be another example. Camp can't help the outcome. You might say, well, the theory is accurate, we did everything, but it didn't work. So, maybe it is that camp is not able to help the outcome. However, there is another alternative. Go to the next slide. An implementation evaluation. So examine the program components as they actually happen live at camp, and assess to what degree they're functioning as intended. How to do this is really the subject of another presentation. So you look at these and you say, well, this is how we thought it would work, but in reality this is how it's actually working live. And then color code the process maps. Red, yellow, and green. As said there, not very effective, moderately, or highly effective. And let me give you an example on the next slide. So here we have the general self-efficacy example, and it's size and color-coded. Now this is on average, not for individual children. The importance of an activity is the size of the bubble, large, medium, and small. And that's based on theory and the time and resources involved. The color is the effectiveness. So green is very effective, yellow is moderately, and red is not very effective. So let me give you a couple of examples. So camp influences self-confidence through the ROBES course. But you couldn't hire a ROBES course person this summer. It fell to the arts and crafts person, unfortunately. They were free, needed to be done. They led the ROBES course, and it was a disaster. The kids just went nuts all over the place. They were fighting. The arts and crafts director was struggling to keep things in order, to get things together, and it just didn't work. So although it had great potential in terms of importance, in reality, it wasn't effective. Let's say you also hired a Knowles person to lead your hikes. This person had gone through the Northern Outdoor Leadership School, through Outward Bound, lots of experience, very child-centered, very knowledgeable. They took these children out on this person on the three-night hike, and they really helped the children process through it and have an incredibly positive experience. So not only is it very important, but it's also very effective. So that's some other examples. For the specific skills, let me tell you why I size things. Now, this may not be the case depending on your children in your camp, but as a general example. The reason I size things like archery, camp, craft, sailing, and the climbing wall smaller than tennis and soccer is because these are things, in terms of skills, that all probably do yield a slight increase in self-confidence and independence, are not really valued in the child's normal environment. When they go back, you're not going to be able to show off their water skiing and their climbing wall ability or their archery ability. So that might have been nice for them, but it isn't valued by their peers and amongst others, which, with whole social comparison theory, is very important. Tennis and soccer, however, might be useful. So if the child, as a result of a camp experience, gets a lot of skill in soccer, that helps them quite a bit in terms of self-confidence. They go back to their normal everyday lives at school. Soccer is played. They're now much better. They're kind of, you know, bumped up a couple levels. They feel better about that. So there's an example. Okay, not to dwell on that point too long. Next step in the evaluative process is to pick which outcomes to evaluate. So, go on to the next slide. Picking which outcomes. To start with, you want to pick the ones where you think you have the biggest effect. And then you want to balance that with the ones that are most central to your mission. So, they're likely things that are important. If you deal with at-risk children, there are five or six things that are really important to hit. And you want to make sure that those would be the ones you look at. Also, you want to make sure that if you have a lot of things that yield to environmental attitudes and awareness, that's something that you evaluate, at least in the initial time. Another example, or another point here, are that there are limitations. You really can't evaluate everything you'd like to, in terms of logistics, money, and the attention span on children. You can't give children a 10-page questionnaire and expect them to fill it out accurately. Okay, so now we're going to talk about designing an evaluation plan and methods. 4 points here: study design and method, sampling, measures, and ethics and consent forms. We're going to go through each of these in turn, and so this is sort of a mini outline for the next few slides. Study design and methods. When to measure. The first day of camp and the last day of camp designs. Quite a few problems with that. If you have a short session, say less than 2, maybe even 3 weeks, children are going to likely remember what they said if you test them the first and last day. If they do remember what they said and they answer based on that memory as opposed to how they actually feel, it might be that you're not getting an accurate assessment of the outcomes of the camp program. I find even though you tell people don't do that, you know, children especially are not that careful about that sort of thing. And, you know, it's like saying, you know, don't pay any attention to the white elephant. Well, if they remember, they're probably going to look at the white elephant. Also, counselors as accurate raters in the beginning. If you ask a counselor to assess a child in the first day, 2 or even 3, they're not really going to know that child very well. Even if they knew that child the previous summer, that child probably isn't the same, given they had lots of things going on the rest of the year. Camp environment, at first, might throw off their replies. So, a child might come to the camp situation, they might be new to it, it might really throw them off, so what they're thinking and feeling the first few days might not be a reflection of them in general, but rather just a reflection of how they feel at that moment. Therefore, if you do note a positive increase, especially a large one by the end of camp, you won't know if that's really this benefit of a camp experience or really just the child becoming more comfortable in the camp environment. Another issue with that first and last day of camp design kind of thing is how long do the effects last? You don't know if they last 4, 8, 12 weeks after camp. Also, it's possible to manipulate outcomes in the lab. So let me give you the example with self-esteem. You can take a child, put them in a lab setting, and influence, or an adult, their self-esteem to the same degree camp does in a matter of 10 minutes. Now, it doesn't last usually very long, but nonetheless, it can be implemented. So, as a result of this first and last day design, we don't know whether we have some sort of enduring change, or whether or not it's just this blip on the map. So I recommend measuring sometime before camp, and then the last day or so, full day of camp. Also, if you want to have the long-term effect of camp, before camp, last day, and some weeks afterwards. So how long to measure? That's sort of a longitudinal design over time. Another way some people do this, which isn't very accurate but can be done, is cross-sectional or point in time. So you might just measure kids the last day of camp and then compare kids who've been there 1, 2, and 3 summers. And you would expect to see a difference in, on average, kids who've been there 1 summer, 2 summers, and 3 summers. Now, when you're doing that, they're not the same children, of course, so it's very sort of iffy kind of proposition. Sequential design is to do both of the above, to measure over time and also take a peek at the cross-sectional aspect based on the number of summers, so you can get this idea without actually spending 4 years doing the evaluation. Best of both worlds, in a sense. So who to measure? Often only campers are tapped. It's also important to use counselors to rate the campers themselves, parents, and teachers really are a difficult thing to use because often kids have a different teacher when they go back. So although teachers would be nice, it tends to not be practical or possible. Sampling issues. So how many is enough? Well, that depends on your questions, logistics, and reality. As a rule of thumb, you want 30 campers for every question option. So let's say you want to know the difference in your program between males and females. That's 2 options. You'd need 60. Now, this isn't the case with all of this. So if you want to look at, you know, all these 8 possible different moderators, ethnicity, age, all that sort of thing, you don't need 30 for every single option. It'd be nice, but it's sort of acceptable to fudge this a little bit and say if you have 5 options total, then you'd want to look at 150 children, almost regardless of what those 5 options were over time, looking at several different things. Again, you'd like to have as many as possible, but that's somewhat of an acceptable thing to do. So who do you pick? Age. Well, often psychometric instruments are designed for children 12 and older because they have much more keen ability to take this sort of thing. There are measures for younger children, but it's very difficult to find one that's appropriate for ages, say, 8 to 16, the age of many camp programs. Also, attention span. Older children have a much larger attention span than younger ones. Another thing that would influence who you pick are the particular subgroup that's of interest to you. Come back to that again in a second. You also want to recognize bias. Campers may represent a unique population, and the results may not generalize. So you might be taking a group of children, if you want to measure the influence on Jewish attitudes, let's say. Let's say you took a group of kids who were already very high in Jewish attitudes. The parents decided to send the kids to camp because they themselves have high Jewish ideals and attitudes, and they hope the camp would continue or to influence that to a degree. That's a different kind of population than the general population. Also, you want to be aware that returning campers are a self-selected group. So if you say that, you know, returning campers, you know, more summers, etc., make a difference, you have to keep in mind that there might be something about the kids you chose not to return. Maybe they're the kids who wouldn't benefit from continued exposure to the camp experience. We don't really know. Matched comparison groups are helpful, often difficult. Randomly assigning children to camp and not camp is the best thing possible, but again, almost always impractical. So how do you pick kids? Well, you can randomly sample is the best thing to do. You always want to randomly sample. So if you have bunches of kids at your camp, what you might do is sort them all out by alphabetical last name and pick every other one. That's a good method. If you don't have so many kids at your camp, you might want to do a population study and pick every kid possible. Strategic sampling is sampling, let's say you're really only interested in females, so you sample only amongst the female population. Some wrenches in the work. Well, there's the initial response rate. You want to have, if you invite 100 people to participate in the study, you want darn near that number to be actually participate. Also, attrition. Over time, if you did this long study over, say, months or weeks, you want the people who started in the study to finish the study. In general, you want 75% or better in a final overall response rate. That's really as low as you'd want to go, though. 80 or 90% should be the target. Lots of things that can be done to help improve that. Phone calls, self-addressed stamped envelope, postcards, real signatures, making sure all of this doesn't take 45 minutes for the kids and parents, communicating the benefit and the reason of this, sending a $2 or $5 bill in with the mailing, sending chocolate, tea, more mailings, all of these things help boost the return rate. So the measures. A few issues here: ability, motivation, honesty, and some things what to do about them. Ability, age. Again, younger children often aren't able to respond in the same way that older children are. They're on a very different cognitive level. So you'd want to pick an appropriate measure or adjust the ages studied. Motivation. Sometimes kids are bored. They don't want to do it. They don't care. Some things, sincerely ask for their help. You'd be surprised how effective that is. Make participation a choice, which is mandatory anyway. And check for consistency in their responses. So there are some scales that do things like ask the same question slightly differently 10 or 12 questions later. And they make sure that the child was filling out, you know, in the same direction on both of those questions. If they weren't, that inconsistency might show boredom. A $2 bill attached to the survey with a little sticky note that says something like, you know, thanks for your time and honesty, helps the little guilt mechanism kick in and helps quite a bit as well. Honesty. Social desirable responding. So that's when people respond, as I said before, differently than they really feel, either consciously or subconsciously. A positive and negative impression scale, somewhat like used on the MMPI, Minnesota Multiphasic Institute, or others, EQ measures have this sort of thing, helps quite a bit. You can adjust the scale based on those scores. And flat-out attempts at deception, a $2 bill helps with that as well. So what makes a good measure? The next two slides are this long list. They're addressed in another presentation entirely. But all of these things need to be met. If they're not met satisfactorily, you don't know what you've got. The data you get back in the end might not reflect reality. And if that's the case, you're going to be making decisions about your camp program and about these children's lives based on information that isn't real and that isn't accurate. And that is a dangerous thing to do. There is almost no instance in life where you would want to make decisions based on that sort of inaccurate information, especially when dealing with camp and with children's lives. Two I've highlighted here, predictive validity. It's extraordinarily hard to have predictive validity. That is, the way a child fills out this measure in a few minutes predicts their future behavioral and life outcomes. People often assume that of scales, very rarely met, and easily one of the primary reasons why the majority of studies that have been done about camp are meaningless or questioned greatly. Next slide, again, more issues. Three sources on the bottom that are useful if you want to look more into this. Remaining measurement issues. There's all these qualitative issues, interviews, case studies, focus groups, youth participatory evaluations. Those have some problems with the sense of memory, social desirable responding, and they can be invalid. So it's important to take that in mind. Another example I've seen is a focus group where people have the counselors nominate the child they want to participate. Not a random sample. There's probably something different about the child the counselors picked to go participate in the focus group, so the results of such information should be viewed with high suspicion. Quantitative. Surveys, sometimes behavioral checklists. Again, very difficult to meet all those standards I just flashed quickly. The motivation, ability, and honesty issues are also there. So in the end, it's best to use the mixed methods. Use quantitative methods to objectively assess if the outcomes were achieved and to what degree, and use the qualitative to assess processes and understand what the experiences of individual children were like. Ethics and consent forums. Participants have several rights. They have the right to withdraw from the study without any duress or consequence. You can't say, if you don't do this, you won't get the ice cream. Or if you don't do this, this will happen. Or, you know, any sort of social pressure whatsoever is completely unethical. They must be informed about the research project on the whole, sort of a paragraph or two explaining what you're doing and why. They need to understand what their responsibilities are. They must be informed about if and how their responses will be kept confidential. Or not if. They need to be kept confidential. All sort of information like that, as you know with IQ scores. They're not just left around for people because they can highly influence people's decisions about how they interact with children. Usually the way this is done is only one person can match a code that each child and parent has given to the actual person. Everyone else who sees all this sees it based on just on this code number. They're given a realistic appraisal of their risks, and they have impartial avenues to express their concerns. So if they have qualms with the study, if the only person they can go to is you or the people conducting it, that's a problem. They need to have somebody impartial to go to. Parents are not informed about their children's scale scores on psychometric measures, and vice versa. It is unethical to tell a parent what their child's self-esteem score. You can discuss it in general, but you may not tell them in particular. Several reasons for that, which I won't get into here. There's also a review board. If it's a university or government sort of study, there's always a review board that assesses the risk, gains, and worthiness of the study. Before I move on, you also want to make sure, the next slide, work the bugs out of the measurement system. You want to make sure the data collectors are comfortable and competent. You want to ensure that the participants respond to procedures and measures intended, and that sample data collected and analyzed should yield reports and information as you envisioned. Okay, so now we're at step 5, conducting the evaluation. Just a brief note on this. You really want to be serious and committed. It takes an enormous amount of time at all levels. Staff involvement and buy-in needs to be high. You have no idea how complicated, how complex, and how involved it really is to conduct an evaluation. Also, there's a significant expense. Materials, professional help, additional staff, and there's often quite a bit of anxiety going around with, oh, are they turning this in? Is it working? What's the return rate? Waiting for the results, etc. So if you're not serious and committed, it's almost not worth it to start. So again, after all that, why should you bother to evaluate? All the benefits on the next slide. And again, if your goal is to help the children who go through your camp experience achieve a world of good in the best way possible, there is absolutely no substitute for evaluating your camp program. There is no way to get the information to help the children better than to undergo a serious evaluation. Next, you want to analyze the results. So, one of three slides here. You need to clean the data, deal with outliers, missing data, random responding, data entry errors, double-checking reliability and consistent answers. You'd be surprised that the quality of data that you often get back. People skip answers, all sorts of things happen. You want to be able to factor out the variability due to social desirable responding. You want to know what the average and standard deviation are for your population, sort of norms. So what difference does it make if in the end you find out that the average is a 62? So what? What does 62 mean? What are, you know, normal children? What are deviant children like? What are exceptional children like? You want to know that. You want to know what a clinically meaningful change is. So the score went from 62 to 64. So what? Is that clinically meaningful? What difference does it make that these 2 points happen? What behaviors are going to be different? What's going to be different about this child as a result of these 2 points? You want to make sure that you don't use chain scores, like subtract, you know, the last day of camp from the first day of camp on a score and say that's the difference. There are a lot of reasons why that's statistically invalid. This isn't a statistics lecture, so I'm not going to go into those. Just know that it isn't kosher. Also, you want to examine what effect the moderators have, that long list of moderators I threw up before. Also note that statistical significance alone is meaningless. You want to know the effect size, not just how probable it is. Also, 90% success is an unreasonable goal. To assume that 90% of the children who go through your program are going to benefit on all these outcomes probably is not reasonable. it would be an exceptional intervention that could have such an achievement rate. A much lower number, perhaps even the neighborhood of 30 to 50%, is probably more reasonable, depending on what it is you're influencing and for whom. Don't violate the assumptions of statistics, particularly UN. Remember the rule of 30. And you want to examine how long effects last. So analyzing the results 2 of 3. Again, you want to look at the processes. You want to assess all the camp inputs, as I mentioned before. You want rich detail on a few campers, what their experiences were like, and what effect that might have had on their outcomes. Some background information, anything that might shed light on the results. And all these things I went over before as to who and does not benefit and why. Okay, analyzing results 3 of 3. As you can see here, there's a long causal chain. So, let's say you have a child, let's say the past is camp. They go to camp experience A. So what happens to them when they're an adult? Well, that depends on all these other things that happen in their future. There's a long sort of causal change, and it depends on all the decisions that go along the way. So it's kind of difficult to look at long-term change in people. Also, it's difficult to trace things back, to say, you know, you look at a child now and you say, well, it's because of these things that happened in the past. Very difficult to know. The transactional view is simply that you need to take into account the environment. Development is not statically determined by some specific event, irrespective of the events it produces on the particular environment. So you have to just keep in mind things that happen in the child's world, and that if you change one thing here, it's probably going to change other things elsewhere. Multiple systems influence the child. As I mentioned before, the family, the school, the peer group, the religious, the culture, both like America and subcultures, government, all of these things. Those other systems are important to consider. Where did the child come from? And where the child will be returning? How will those other systems react, support, or discourage changes that occur as a result of the camp program? One can also be certain that systems change over time, thus systems are dynamic. All of this could be an entire presentation in and of itself, just touching on these issues. The immeasurable change. Here people often say, okay, let me give you a medical example. So, with kidney stones, what they do is they have these three rays of sound that converge and destroy the kidney stone. If they just used one ray of sound, it would destroy all the tissue on the way to the kidney stone. It's really the convergence of the three that has the effect. People who look at long-term sort of change say, well, that's the way when you do these pre-post outcomes of a camp experience, you're really diluted, because you have to keep in mind that camp may be like one of those rays of light. If you try and measure it, you'll see that there is no effect. But when it converges with other things along the line later, you do have an effect. Now, I agree with that. That's absolutely the case. Good example. However, if you can't show an effect a couple of years later, or a few years later down the line, then you probably aren't talking about very much. Ultimate change. Adults with and without a camp experience. If you want to carry it to the end, you'd want to be able to tell an adult who did and did not go to camp apart. If you could not tell those two groups apart in any way, shape, or form, you'd have to agree that camp did not make a difference. So, you have to ask, can our program alone have a significant influence on this outcome? If other systems influence the child, then one can't necessarily say that camp failed if a long-term outcome is not achieved. But if camp can instill long-term change, almost regardless of the influences of other systems, then the change camp creates is truly a powerful one. So let's move on to the next slide. Utilizing the results, all the things on the Why Evaluate slide apply. The benefits of a serious, accurate evaluation are that you can tweak your processes for real. You can benchmark theoretically accurate processes with other camps industries, subject of another presentation again, and prove how the processes are actually implemented. Crucial, I could go on about that as an entire presentation again. Communicate your mission and objectives more clearly and accurately, And in general, for every outcome you evaluate, the children will reap enormous benefits heretofore not possible, which, after all, is why we're here in the first place. And hopefully, while you're listening to this. So the last step is to begin again. After you've gone through this whole thing, you're going to want to start over because things change over time, and you won't have been able to measure everything the first time around. The top 15 evaluation mistakes. First, people don't use fully valid, reliable, and appropriate measures that meet all the criteria. The subject of another presentation. If you don't know what you're measuring, what you're actually getting back, it's hard to make any decision based on that. Huge problem in camping research, and a lot of research in general. Behavioral indicators are not assessed, just proxies of them. A thorough literature review isn't undertaken, so we know the library of knowledge that people have gained before we actually undertook this. Evaluations are atheoretical, they aren't theory-driven. They measure just the first and last day of camp, all the problems I talked about before. Long-term effects of camp are not assessed. They use qualitative data alone, or they try and use qualitative data to objectively assess outcomes or determine cause, which is inappropriate. They don't examine the processes involved, the subject of entire presentation, crucial. They don't examine the implementation of those processes, again, crucial. I've worked with camps where they had the processes, they did the theory, everything. Again, implementation evaluation is also absolutely essential. Or only the camper's perspective is tapped, number 11, not the counselors and parents as well. An examination of the moderators is not thoroughly undertaken. All those things that might influence the outcomes. People just throw out averages and they leave it at that. The size of the effect isn't noted or not calculated. You just say 62-63 or 62-68, meaningless. Basic research methods are violated, random sampling and appropriate comparison groups, etc. And lastly, sample bias isn't eliminated. Those are the top 15 evaluation mistakes. Not all of these can be addressed in every study, but as many of them should be as possible. So how to hire an evaluator. You may have a staff member or a consultant, may be the better option. Whoever you hire, they should have expansive knowledge about everything in this presentation and the other presentations as well, the measurement one and the process one. They should have a solid grasp of the theories relevant to summer camp and the outcomes you're interested in evaluating. Fields relevant include developmental, social, and organizational psychology, as well as the field of recreation and leisure. There are also several roles evaluators can serve. Evaluation, pure and simple, is just the systematic determination of the merit, worth, and significance. This is sort of the outcome evaluation. You might be able to find someone that's good at that. Another role you would want an evaluator to serve is diagnosing and explaining, sort of the needs assessment, process evaluation, implementation evaluation. Again, not everybody's good at either one or both. Recommending, very dangerous, often asked of evaluators, need to be aware of all the ramifications of that. Clients are likely going to blame the evaluation if they don't like the results, and recommending is an incredibly slippery slope to tread. Teaching evaluation. So this is when you hire someone as an evaluation consultant. I'm not doing the evaluation, you do it. I'm just consulting on the process. Often what people do as well is they hire an evaluation consultant to sort of supervise, critique, and work with another evaluation team, which I highly recommend. And last, monitoring. On time, on budget, on task. So at this point, I'd normally ask for questions and discussion. Thank you for listening through this whole thing from start to finish. If you do have questions or would like to discuss things in this, I am definitely open to doing that. Please give me a ring. You can contact me with the website noted throughout the presentation. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time and attention, and I am glad that hopefully when you engage in evaluation, that the children at your camp will benefit as a result.